single reference to Facebook or Twitter, and only one to Google. Yet, if you look at the world around you and the way it is shaped by digital media in general and social media in particular, you see a complete transformation. Grassroots political movements flourish as never before thanks to social media. And even mainstream politicians now have to consider not only how their rhetorical sallies will be reported in the mainstream press and on television, but how they will travel on social media. It just so happens that 2009 was exactly the year in which Twitter's rate of growth started to really shoot up. In 2008, it was growing at 750-odd%. In 2009, at twice that rate. Facebook started the turbocharged phase of its ascent a little earlier. But still, if you compare its user base as 2007 dawned with its user base 3 years later, it's a jump of multiples. As I write, Twitter boasts 320 million active users, Facebook, 1.55 billion. And this ignores Instagram, Tumblr, Snapchat, YouTube, and the countless other apps and services with which people now share information and through which data, aka our thoughts, our feelings, and our amusing Hitler-resembling pussycats, propagates. Is all this, as you might ask, a game changer? I should say, though I'm no oracle, yes and no. Yes, the advent of social media has changed, definitively and for good and all, at least until the next thing comes along, the way much rhetoric is done. But no, it has not changed one bit, not fundamentally, the way rhetoric works. How do I make that distinction? It's sometimes said that we're out of sync. Our technology is space age, while our civilizations or institutions are medieval, and our emotions are still stone age. This is what we might call a suggestive oversimplification. But it points to something real. Anyone who's watched the lumbering way in which Western legal institutions attempt to play catch-up with technology can see the gap between the first and second of those propositions. Anyone who's seen the ageless reaction of a teenager being bullied, whether it be taunting on social media or the good old analog point-and-jeer method I remember from the playground, will recognize the truth of the third proposition. So the way rhetoric works through these different technologies adapts to the technologies, but the way it works on us, our fears and desires, our deep-seated tribal feelings, is pretty much the same as ever. It emphatically doesn't mean rhetoric is on the way out. It means rather that it's changing form. And that change is extremely interesting. Through human history, every new art form or communicative technology, and rhetoric falls into both categories, has been greeted with a mixture of excitement and fear. Those fears tend to be substantially the same, that it will shorten our attention spans, erode our seriousness, hamper our ability to communicate, and or undermine civil society. Socrates regarded the development of the written word as a bad thing. It would cause the arts of memory to fall into disrepair, and with them, the skill of thinking. People would imagine that because they had read something, they understood it. We would have everywhere knowledge and nowhere wisdom. When I was growing up, similar anxieties attended the use of pocket calculators in math class. We know Socrates thought this, incidentally, thanks to the miracle of the written word. So too, in various ways over the years, did cultural paranoia attend the development of silent reading, movable type, and the distribution of the Bible in the vernacular. When the novel first became popular as a form, it was widely regarded as a morally suspect and brain-rotting form of entertainment. Likewise, the theatre. In Jane Austen's morally suspect, brain-rotting Mansfield Park, you know that certain of the characters are a bit scandalous,